Hello, friends. This is the Huga Nurse Podcast, where we discuss all things that you can do to improve your health by being intentional about your home, your environment, the people that you talk to, and your food. I am Rachel Zimmer. I'm a nurse practitioner and a health researcher. My work centers around programs that address food insecurity and food as medicine. I'm also the owner of Huga Abode. It's an online business, and we support women, makers, and fair trade workers worldwide by providing sustainable home goods. Today, I actually had the greatest opportunity to speak to Christina Saldana. She's a physician assistant who specializes in menopausal and sexual health, and she's the founder and owner of Camel City Women's Wellness, which is an integrative health office here in North Carolina. If you're interested in learning about how your environment, your sleep, and your exercise and self-care influence your hormonal health, this is the episode for you. Hormonal health is a topic that doesn't get nearly enough conversation. There are many things that you could do today to influence your own well-being as a woman, and I hope that our conversation today will spark some strategies for you. So grab some warm coffee or tea and snuggle up for some great conversation. Hey, friends. I am talking with Christina Saldana today. She is the owner and founder of Camel City Women's Wellness, which is an integrative women's health practice here in North Carolina. So, Christina, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Rachel.
So I know that many women, myself included, start to think about hormonal health when they hit the age of 40. I don't even think I gave it much of a thought, until for myself at least, until I hit 40. But as a healthcare provider, I also know that there are things that we could do to set us up for better success for hormonal health that go beyond what we usually think about when it comes to hormonal therapies. So I'm really excited to talk to you about this today. But first, I wanted everyone to get a better sense of who you are. So could you tell me a little bit about you?
Yeah. So I'm Christina Saldana. I am a PA. I've been a PA since 2017, and I am also a mother. I have two relatively young children. I'm married to a physical therapist. We've lived in Winston-Salem for about 10 years, but originally from Raleigh, so North Carolina is home to me. That's a little bit about me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm not going to go into like who your favorite college basketball team is, because that's such a North Carolina thing to do.
Well, I'm from Raleigh, so I'll just say that.
Yeah.
And I also went to NC State.
Oh, the triad. So I wanted to know, I want to know more about what your passion is related to your career and what prompted you to open your own practice. That's a big step.
It's a huge step. And if you would have told me this even 5 years ago that I would have opened my own practice, I would have been like, who are you talking to? But I really have to say, and I usually start off by telling people this story about when I was in fourth grade, because it just tells you how long and how long I've had this passion to work with women and be in this kind of space in some sort of capacity. So I remember very vividly when my mom took me into her bedroom. I'm the oldest child of three, but she took me into her bedroom, sat me down, and she had gotten this book from the library about just like childbirth. And it had all these pictures of like pregnant moms, and they were all nude, and you know, you could see their breasts. They had pictures of women birthing babies. And I just thought it was like the most fascinating book. I had no care what she was really trying to tell me about like periods and what was going to happen to me. And I come from a very open household, but you know, I wasn't like so much like hooked on that. I was just like, wow, this is like so amazing that women and female bodies do this. So starting after that, I was like, okay, I'm going to be a gynecologist. Like I just would tell people that. People would ask me like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I wouldn't say a doctor or nurse. I would say I want to be a gynecologist. So, but then I kind of have an unconventional path to medicine. So I went to undergrad at High Point University, and then I got a master's degree at NC State. And then I started traveling. I traveled to India and Ethiopia I would go for a couple months at a time. And I did this over the next couple of years, and I was volunteering, working with women in that capacity. I wasn't really sure. I knew I wanted to work with women again, but I wasn't really sure what that looked like. I didn't understand what capacity that was in. And so when I came back home, I ended up going to yoga teacher training school, and I became a yoga teacher and did that full time for several years. And I loved that. And I actually am still a yoga teacher to this day, but I knew that I wanted to get a little bit more nitty gritty working with women, again, going back to that medical type of setting. So I went to PA school. When I was in PA school, which I did that at High Point University, again, my focus was on women's. My elective rotations were in some sort of women's health field, and I ended up working in gynecologic oncology, taking care of women with ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, uterine cancer. And I was in that role, I was really passionate about working with survivors. So survive, like a cancer survivor is anybody who from the time they complete treatment up until 5 years, and then women will continue to be seen in that clinic. And what I was really passionate about when I was working with those women was talking to them about hormones and menopause and sexual health and how cancer treatments either impacted those things or the cancer diagnosis itself impacted those things. Mm. And what I found was that I could take their vitals, listen to their heart and lungs, do an exam, make sure they were all clear from a cancer perspective, but I had literally no idea how to help them with some of these questions they were asking about: hot flashes, trouble sleeping, irritability, problems with their sexuality. So I started doing some additional coursework and trainings, and it really just formed this deep connection with, like, this is what I'm meant to do. And this is where I'm meant to show up for women in a medical office setting. And so I ended up moving into a family medicine job thinking, all right, I'll have more continuity of care. I'll be able to see them more frequently. It won't just have to be for their, 3-month cancer checkup. I can kind of bring them back next week, 2 weeks, but this was at the beginning of the pandemic. So moving into family medicine at the beginning of a pandemic, it was just a lot. And so I was very supported by my leaders to continue to see women in this capacity in this clinic, but it was just hard. And really, to be frank, my clinic, my private practice clinic now, is really born out of a combination of burnout, professional burnout from traditional medical practice, the deep passion for me to help women live their best lives, and my own desire to have freedom and my own wellness within my own life. And so that's really what Camel City Women's Wellness is founded out of. I noticed that the generally healthy woman was kind of falling through the cracks in a busy medical office. Like she didn't really have any outstanding chronic diseases, uncontrolled blood pressure, poorly controlled diabetes, but she still had questions about her health, or sometimes she didn't have the language to be able to verbalize what's going on with her. And so those types of interactions take time and trust with your healthcare provider. And so that's what my practice is founded on.
I really love that. So I am that woman, who goes into the office and I don't really have any complaints. Maybe my knee hurts occasionally, but, I'm in my 40s now. And as a healthcare provider, though, you think, oh, I should have the answers to these questions. I should know these things. But honestly speaking, we just don't get a lot of that in our curriculum.
No.
And then secondly, people just don't want to talk about it, to your point. Like, I happen to have a really good female physician who does want to talk about it. But if I didn't have her, I don't know that I would where I would get the information. So I'm grateful that you're going to talk about that a little bit today.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of women who have lots of questions.
Yes, we all do, right? And we all deserve the time and the space to unpack some of that and be able to kind of share with somebody and also get And even if somebody doesn't have the exact answer, but just for somebody to like share their concern and like have an empathetic ear.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally feel that. All right. So let's dig into some of that.
Okay.
So tell me, what are some hormonal changes that women tend to experience when they're entering their 30s? Because usually that's kind of when you start seeing some changes. Yeah. And
maybe starting there and then kind of moving, you know, as they get older.
Yeah. So what I tell women is a lot of what we can talk about can be all of these internal changes, but there's also a lot of external changes that can influence these internal changes as well. But it can be quite complex, but I'm going to try to make it a little bit simple to think about in terms. So when women enter their third decade of life or after they turn 30, their ovarian reserve starts going down. It really truly has been going down since the day she was born, but like the height of her fertility is really in her 20s, like late teens into her 20s. As she enters into her 30s, her fertility starts to go down, but the reason her fertility goes down is because her ovarian reserve is going down and estrogen levels start to decline. We usually think of this in the way of fertility, you know, like the biological clock, or we, you know, as soon as a woman hits 35, if she gets pregnant after that, you know, we now turn that as a geriatric pregnancy, or we tell women they may have more trouble getting pregnant after 35. All of that, you know, we talk about it that as fertility, but all of that relates to declining hormone levels. And so when we just hone in as medical providers that this is a fertility problem, we miss all the women who are either done having children or they have just chosen not to have biological children. We've just kind of like missed that whole group of people, right? And so it's like, well, if you're not trying to get pregnant or you don't care about not getting pregnant, then really there's not really anything for you to worry about. But this is still an opportunity where we can say hormone levels are declining. You may or may not start to notice anything. You may start to notice things. And I tell people it can happen really at any time. It can happen mid 30s, late 30s, early 40s. But as estrogen levels start to decline, your periods may start to get a little bit irregular. And I generally say you may notice maybe one period every year seems a little bit weird. You skipped it. It came late. It came a little early. You notice your cycle length is changing, either getting shorter or longer. I mean, there's a variety of changes that can happen, but I just generally say you may notice some changes in your period. When you're noticing changes in your period, that also means you may or may not be ovulating regularly. And if you are not ovulating regularly, then your ovaries are not producing progesterone. That's the only place in our bodies that progesterone is produced. So not only do you have this declining level of estrogen, now you're having kind of this sporadic progesterone production if and only if she's ovulating. And this is just speaking about people that get regular periods, right? So there's it can be a whole other can of worms for people who maybe have endometriosis or PCOS or any other type of hormonal conditions or period irregularity conditions that have or have not been diagnosed. Sometimes these things don't even get diagnosed until later in their life. The other hormone that starts to decline is testosterone. Testosterone is also produced by the ovaries. So that starts to decline as well. Actually, that starts declining in the late 20s. And so all of this is going on internally. And then also on the external, her caregiving duties may have increased. If she has children, she's raising children. Sometimes these children are teenagers, sometimes they're toddlers. I mean, each stage of childhood, parenthood has its own set of concerns, but she also may be caring for aging parents. And so she may be changing a career. She may be going back to work after her kids have gone to school. She may be, you know, going back to school. And so that can influence her amount of stress and cortisol production, which can further influence kind of those periods and all of that, all of the hormonal system, right? It's quite complex. But all of these changes lead to downstream effects. We talked a little bit about period changes, but things like brain fog, fatigue, low motivation, just feeling like she can't get up, feeling that sense of overwhelm that she no longer has control over. Particularly the declining estrogen levels can lead to hot flashes or night sweats. That's huge. She may notice some joint pain, muscle aches that she can't really, you know, she didn't have an injury. Things just kind of feel achy. She also, all of these things may lead her to be a little bit more sedentary, which can also worsen these problems. She also may start to notice some body changes. She might notice some weight gain around her midsection. And this is not generally subcutaneous fat. This is visceral fat. So this is fat that doesn't readily come off with the usual, all the usual things that we know to do. And then furthermore, she may also start to notice things changing with her blood pressure going up, her cholesterol panel changing, maybe some blood sugar dysregulation. So there's a lot going on, right? And so sometimes she's noticing a little bit of this. Sometimes she's noticing a lot of this. Sometimes all she says, and actually there was an article that was just published in the May Journal of the Menopause Society, that when women are experiencing all this, they're not coming in saying, my joints hurt. They're coming, or, you know, my joints hurt, or I'm having vaginal dryness, or I'm having night sweats. They come in saying, I'm not feeling like myself. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Now we have this term, not feeling like myself, or NFLM. And so that's kind of how they describe these things. Again, not having necessarily the language or the wherewithal to kind of package all of these together, right? Because then mm-hmm. I will oftentimes hear women say, well, it's not that bad, or it's not as bad as so-and-so. But I always tell people, this is what your experience is. And so depending on how she's experiencing this, this is how it's going to have an impact on her well-being. Sometimes women say, you know, I'm not feeling really bothered by anything. I feel fine. We still know that some of these changes, these hormonal changes in particular, are happening. But I tell people, we just go based on your experience. So if you are extremely bothered by these symptoms, it warrants an investigation. But also, I think every person is deserving of knowing what's going on with their bodies.
I love that. It's sort of the black box of symptoms, because, you know, the not feeling like myself, or, gosh, I've just been more tired recently and I don't know why, or, you know, I don't feel like I'm the person I used to be. Those are all the things that sometimes you'll hear women say. And I wonder how much of that is because you just did a really good job of naming, like, the things inside of the black box. And I'm not sure if I really hear those things named in a public context.
Yeah, they're not. And, you know, when I, you know, if I have a patient in an interaction and I'm reading off a review of systems and I'm kind of going through everything, and she's like, yes, that, yes, that, yes, that, yes, that. And it's like, okay, then we have a framework within which to work with. But she's not necessarily coming in naming out all those things, right? So we're not like really publicly or obviously discussing these like one by one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really good. And then, you know, to your point, when you're in your 30s, your career typically is sort of on the incline. If you're in a professional setting, your family pressures are increasing. And so then there's all the other reasons in your environment that could be contributing to the ways that you're feeling, going back to what you were saying about the internal things as well.
Yeah,
that's a really good point.
It's interesting that too, because a lot of women will say, well, I just assumed it was XYZ. You know, her kids or her partner, or she's caregiving her, you know, her mom or something like that, taking her mom to appointments or whatnot. And I tell people it matters, but it also doesn't matter. If you don't feel well, like, there's something for us to work with. And
right. We
may never be able to suss out what it is, right? I think if we focus more on the getting better aspect or the feeling better aspect, rather than necessarily figuring out, oh, what is the precise thing that's going on here? Because the truth is that we're complicated people. We have complicated lives and we're busy people. And so I think the key take home point for that is to just focus on what you can do to be well.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So moving into the next question, like, how could women tell the difference between what would be considered normal changes and then what might be like a sign of a health issue or a hormonal imbalance?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I know like all the things I just listed sound like all big issues, right? And they can be. I tell people if it's something is bothering you, even if you can't verbalize what that is, if something's bothering you, it warrants further evaluation and at least some education around what may be happening. Perimenopause and menopause, these hormonal fluctuations, they're not pathologic in nature. It's not a disease state in and of itself. It's a natural continuum of life. which is why I say not all women are going to experience maybe bothersome symptoms, you know, outright so. But if something is interrupting her sleep, if something is interrupting her work, if something is interrupting her relationships, or if something's interrupting anything that she enjoys or loves to do, then I say that that is a sign that there may be something going on and that we need to do a little bit deeper looking at.
Yeah, I like that. So speaking of sleep and relationships, how do lifestyle factors like diet, exercise, stress management, sleep, how does that either support or not support your wellness?
Yeah, so Rachel and I were talking about this before we came on because this is so huge. I tell people that diet, exercise, stress management, and sleep, these are the unsung heroes of hormone wellness. There's no amount of supplements. I always tell people you can't supplement your way out of burnout. You can't prescription your way out of just crappy sleep. So there's just no amount of medications or supplementation that can really get to the root of any type of hormonal issue without these other factors involved. So I tell people and educate my patients that if you truly want to optimize your hormonal health, you absolutely cannot ignore these items. And so, and I think some of this comes down to just people being really honest with themselves. So I wanted to use sleep for an example here. So we should be getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night. And if we don't, if we're delaying our bedtime or forcing ourselves to get up early to like make sure we get that exercise in, or if we're having interrupted sleep, our sleep's going to be dysregulated. And if our sleep's dysregulated, our cortisol is going to be dysregulated. Our ovarian hormone function is going to be dysregulated. And then poor sleep in and of itself is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, depression, anxiety, worsening ADHD, poor cognition, brain fog. And it's even a leading cause and reason for car accidents. So sleep is, we can't do without our good quality sleep. So we really need to think about targeting sleep with sleep hygiene, daytime stress mitigation, exposure to early morning sunlight that can help set circadian rhythms. And then if you're still struggling with sleep, especially sleep interruption, whether it's like you've got to get up and go to the bathroom, you're waking up with anxiety in the middle of the night, or you're having hot flashes, I mean, those things need to be addressed alongside a medical provider. But there can just not be enough said about how important these items are to managing hormone health.
I'm glad you brought up sleep hygiene. I actually bring that up in one of my little digital courses, talking about how important sleep is for your health and how your bedroom environment impacts the quality of sleep you get. But you brought up sleep hygiene. So we throw that term around a lot. So when you're talking about sleep hygiene, what are things that you'll tell people to start integrating into their routine?
Yeah, so that's huge because there's like a lot of like research and data about how sleep hygiene works, doesn't work, is great, all these things, like you should do all these things. I generally try to keep it pretty simple for people. I think that, you know, the recommendation for avoiding your phone or blue light for 2 hours before bed is great, but sometimes that's difficult to do, right? In our day and age of screens, I generally tell people to kind of make a rule for themselves. What time are you going to cut all that stuff off? So, you know, finishing dinner by 7, maybe finishing phones and TVs by 8 or 9, generally, you know, at least an hour before bedtime. If somebody's working on going to bed earlier, you know, say they're going to bed every night at 1 because they're working, they're playing on their phone, they're, you know, trying to maximize kid-free time. But they realize that they need to go to bed earlier, I tell them to back it up by 15 minutes at a time. So like no big leaps, right? Because then we might fail, we might get disappointed and then not go back to it. So I say back up your bedtime by 15 minutes at a time. Not eating too late in the evening. And again, taking care of stressful things and managing your stress during the day. I tell people that sometimes it's not what you do right before bed, but it's what you're doing throughout the day for your sleep hygiene, like getting exercise, early morning sun exposure, taking care of difficult things, difficult conversations in the daytime, and then focusing on the night for relaxation, avoiding screen time or cutting it off at a certain time. not eating within 3 hours of going to bed, and then backing up gradually your bedtime if you need to do that.
I love that. Yeah, I recently read something, and I don't know why I never put this together, but, you know, we talk about blue light, but I had read something, I don't think it was one of the scientific journals, but it was just talking about how when the sun comes up, and you wake up, and there's no clouds in the sky is blue, right? Like, so that's your blue light. It's a trigger to wake up. So
yeah.
It's sort of how nature was made. And when the sun is setting, that's when you see the warmer colors of the oranges and the reds. And so we were just made to be in rhythm with the sun.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the idea of like the short wave, the blue light, the short wave. That's just part of like how nature was made.
Yeah. I love that. I actually use a sleep lamp that has the sunset and the sunrise. It's much mm-hmm. more pleasant to wake up with the gradual light rather than like a blaring alarm. It feels like no matter yeah. how you change your ringtone for your alarm, it still is jarring. But to wake yeah. up with the sun, it's really helpful in the wintertime. And then also like you just tap the thing and you have a sunset and a little meditation before bed. And that's been particularly helpful for me. Again, it's no, I didn't get it out of a scientific journal, but I think it's great. And again, that's how we were made. Like, we're solar powered.
We are. That's beautiful. We're solar powered. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
So, so discuss with me maybe some general, just conventional, maybe alternative approaches to hormonal wellness that kind of go beyond like how to control your environment and your stress. But now if we're getting into, okay, well, we want to really address, you know, our hormonal wellness beyond that, what are some things that you recommend generally?
Yeah. So conventional medical providers, and I think things that probably both you and I were taught in our medical training, focuses a lot about managing women's hormonal concerns with hormonal birth control. And I am not a birth control naysayer. I have really nothing bad to say about birth control, particularly if we are wanting to use birth control to avoid a pregnancy. I mean, I think the risks of an unintended pregnancy far outweigh any theoretical risks of hormonal birth control. However, 58% of women who are using birth control are not using it for pregnancy prevention. They're using it for some sort of hormonal regulation. And it's not the wrong answer. It's not a bad answer. It's just maybe not the best answer for all circumstances. I think that that's conventionally just our gut reaction is, oh, you're having irregular periods, or, oh, you're having some mood changes, you know, around your period, or now you're getting into perimenopause and your mood is very erratic and you're irritable and everything's all over the place. So I think that the gut reaction from a conventional standpoint is to put somebody on birth control pills. However, that's not, you know, sometimes we'll use these words like we're giving birth control to regulate things. We're not really regulating anything. We're actually just shutting down ovulation so that there's no more cycling, which again, it's not a bad answer if that's what we need to achieve. However, I think that we as a medical society have been so scared of prescribing hormone replacement therapy and using bioidentical or body identical or biosimilar hormones during this time of fluctuation, thinking, oh, we can only give those to people until they've been, you know, now they're postmenopausal, they've been a full year without a period, now we can use these things. And so what I like to do, and, you know, I think of it as an alternative, but also this should be like the mainstream way that we manage these types of hormonal fluctuations, particularly in somebody's 40s, is to start using perimenopausal doses of hormone replacement therapy or hormone therapy, because what it's doing is it's not shutting down ovulation. So it's not going to prevent against an unwanted pregnancy. So if that's still very important, birth control should still be considered. But if you know, she's not partnered, or she's not having, you know, penetrative sex or whatnot, using menopausal hormone therapy during this time period can be really beneficial. It actually has a greater chance of symptom reduction than birth control, because you're giving the body back exactly what it needs, or exactly what is fluctuating or declining too quickly. And so it's giving it back to her right away. So I particularly like to use transdermal preparations of estrogen. Transdermal preparations of estrogen have been shown to be efficacious to help with mood and anxiety disorders. And this comes out of some research done by reproductive psychiatrists who specifically treat women in the postpartum period and as well as menopausal mood-related things, that transdermal preparations actually penetrate the brain tissue a little bit better and help with brain fog, fatigue, anxiety. Sometimes we can use this instead of having to put her or increase her depression or anxiety medications. That's another conventional thing that we usually use is SSRIs or serotonin reuptake inhibitors or SNRIs. So all of those depression and anxiety medications, again, not a terrible answer. If we need to treat, you know, a refractory depression or anxiety, those are great tools, but they come with risks and side effects that sometimes are really unwanted and can be really pervasive during this time period in her life, namely weight gain and decrease in sexual functioning, which is typically and sometimes already happening just because of what her body is experiencing. So again, if we're using bioidentical hormone prescription therapy, then sometimes I tell people we're meeting you exactly where your body wants to be. We're giving you back what your body is struggling to do without, or it's fluctuating too much. So we're giving it right back to you. And these are things that they don't have to be compounded. You can get bioidentical hormones from regular retail pharmacies. So it does not have to be a big expense. Another thing that happens alternatively is sometimes women will feel like they need to have these expensive tests done, or they need to have these urinary metabolites done, or these saliva testings done. And really, in my humble opinion, that's not always needed either. I mean, sometimes we just need to treat the patient and meet her where she's at and not treat a lab.
Mm. Very good points.
Yeah.
So you've given a lot of great advice. What are some other things that have come to mind while you've been talking? Are there like just tips that you integrate into your own life, for example,
that
has been helpful?
So my tips are, they're going to sound very simplistic, but I think they're pretty hard, and they're hard for me as well. And one of them is to decrease our amount of social media that we are consuming. I'm thinking about that in my own children. As my children are still too young for social media, but I know that there's going to come a time where that's going to become something, right? And so now it's easy to say, well, they're not using it because they're not old enough. But that's something I've been thinking about for them, for myself, and for my patients. So I want people to still be informed, and I want to be informed. But sometimes these messages that we're getting on social media are either inaccurate, or there's just things portrayed on there. I mean, people feel poorly about themselves. I know that I do. I have to take frequent breaks from social media. So I say decreasing social media consumption, which can be really hard, right? But I think that is really important. I think another really important piece for hormonal wellness and wellness as we age is boundaries and, you know, manifesting good relationships in our lives, and also learning when to say no, when to saying I've had enough of this, I'm going to remove myself from this situation. So really being honest with ourselves and the people around us and how to set good boundaries. They're also a difficult thing to do. And the last piece that I think, and I struggle with this as well, but it's just be honest with yourself. Like, if I'm feeling poorly, which I can use yesterday as an example. I went to the beach over the weekend. I had a really nice time. I am so rejuvenated by being by the ocean and felt good and was able to not do any work. And then Monday I hit the ground running. It's been a very busy week for me the last several days. And I am just like, I don't feel good, but I have not been exercising the last 3 days. I have not been prioritizing my sleep. And I've skipped lunch for the last 3 days in a row. And so you have to really be honest with yourself and say, okay, what are we going to do here? Like, I know I don't feel good because I haven't been focusing on these things, right? And so it's very difficult when we get busy and we want to do a lot and we're helping people and we're mothering or we're taking care of things in the house. But I think we just have to be honest with ourselves and prioritize our self-care. which I talk to people about all day long. And I also think that in general, I prioritize self-care pretty well. But, you know, we're humans and sometimes we slip back into these old patterns and these old ways. So again, just being honest with yourself, giving yourself some grace, and then just trying again.
I love that. Yeah, I wanted to touch on a couple of things that you were talking about. One is social media. So I noticed that the World Health Organization just had their happiness report come out, and you probably saw that our happiness has declined in the American, or our American happiness has declined, and they're attributing a lot of that to our 20 to 30-something-year-old group of people who are suffering specifically because of social media use is the theory behind that. I think that's really quite striking. We were already suffering before, and I think we're 32nd now out of all of the countries in the world.
Yeah. And there's a book called The Anxious Generation. It's about like raising children and how like anxiety is becoming more prevalent in children. Mm-hmm. And there's also some thoughts about that that's likely due to social media. So, you know, if it's impacting younger generations, I mean, it impacts everybody, right? And it's just, it's not realistic. And it's so difficult. And it's so crazy to me because it's so easily accessible. I mean, like, I have my phone sitting right here. Like, in 2 seconds, I could pull up Instagram or Facebook or whatever and like just be very rapidly consuming information. So that's a big one for me. And that's something I really talk to patients about.
Yeah. Yeah. And the boundaries, that's something that's been a lifelong thing for me, boundaries. And I will say one of the reasons I started this business was because I have felt that I had lost a lot of those boundaries during the pandemic, because we as healthcare providers were expected to be everything to everybody and everything to our families and save the world. And oh, by the way, don't listen to the news because you don't want to hear what they're talking about in there. And so, yeah, but it became sort of that your work merged into your home life, into your sleep, and then, you know, going back to the hormonal imbalances that occur because of that. But the importance, or my anxiety decreased quite a bit after I started putting those boundaries back in.
Yeah.
I think that's where I was going to go with that. Once I said, you know what, no more of that. We're going to put boundaries around that and started being very intentional about it. I actually saw that it was those intentional things that helped with the anxiety and the feelings of overwhelm that I was having.
It's so cyclical, because as our resilience goes down because of burnout or stress, or we're just not taking care of ourselves, it's very difficult to maintain those boundaries. So like, we have to focus on the self-care and the building of our resilience back up so that we are in a good place where we can be able to say no, set those boundaries. And something that really struck me, what you just said about being a healthcare provider, because we're taking care of people, right? We're not taking care of equipment or numbers, or we're taking care of other human beings. And so my acupuncturist a couple years ago told me this, and I think about this every single day. And this can be, if this is somebody else's mantra, then I'm so helpful that this can help you. But what she said to me is, don't confuse your compassion with charity. Yeah. And so I think about that, because sometimes we, as healthcare providers, we think, oh, we got to help this person, and we got to do these things for these people. And we kind of get in this circular rut, and particularly during the pandemic. And, you know, as I said, I mean, my business was born out of burnout from working in family medicine and during the pandemic. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel that.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have any recommendations? You had mentioned a book. Are there any other recommendations that you have? If people want to learn more about how to care for themselves, do you have any resources or books that could be helpful?
Yeah. So I actually, that's so funny you said that, because right before we jumped on, I was like, I need to have a list of things in case I have a list of, need a list of resources. So there's a couple of books out there. Actually, there's a lot of books out there. And if somebody comes to my office, they'll see all the books that I have. But some of my favorites are You Are Not Broken by Kelly Casperson. There's another book called Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski, and she wrote another book with her sister called Burnout. And burnout is all about how to set boundaries and how to like get yourself out of this cyclical burnout phase. That book was actually probably the straw that got me to think outside of my own self when I was feeling really burnout in my job. There's another book called It's Not Hysteria by Kim Tang. And she talks about how like hormonal concerns and what that looks like. And also from a historical context of this word hysteria and how that's kind of been very pervasive in women's health. Yes. And then there's another book called The New Menopause by Dr. Mary Claire Haver. And this book is just about perimenopause and menopause and how to kind of take control of your life. And then if women are really feeling led that they need to work with a provider, there's two resources that they can find somebody who specializes in these types of conditions. And one is the Menopause Society. So you can go to menopause.org and find a provider that's close to you. And the other one is the International Society for Women's Sexual Health, or ISSWSH, I-S-S-W-S-H. You can also find a provider there. And a lot of those providers focus on hormones and wellness and all kinds of things, women's health, that maybe you're not quite getting, you know, from your current provider.
That's a great resource. Thank you. Yep. And so I'll put all that in the show notes.
Okay, cool.
So that people can access it easily. All right, last very important question. If you could be any macaroni shape, which macaroni shape would you choose?
I love this question so much. And I had a difficult time thinking about this because I am half Italian, so I am very well versed in my pasta shapes.
Wow.
Yes, but I would have to go with a rigatoni. And the reason why is because it cooks very predictably, which is so me. And also I'm a very saucy type of person in a lot of sense of the words, both literally and figuratively. And rigatoni, I think, holds sauce the best. So.
Oh my gosh, I love that. What a great answer. Well, Christina, thank you for being here today.
Thank
and
you
thank
so
you
much.
For all the great insight.
Thank you so much.
I just want to take a moment and thank you so much for joining us today. Once more, I want to thank Diane Schenberger for joining me on the show to talk to us about her work as a nutritionist and her thoughts about how to integrate a more plant-forward approach into your eating habits each day. Our research together has been very rewarding and very challenging at the same time. There are many communities across the United States that do not have access to healthy foods, and this is causing significant health problems for both children and adults. If you want to learn more about ways that you can help be an advocate access, I will include some links in the show notes. Also, be sure to follow me on social media and sign up for my newsletter at hugaabode.com, where I'll talk and dig into some of these things some more. The links for this, plus the resources that Diane spoke about today, are all included in the show notes. And don't forget to leave us a review. In next week's episode, we will talk with Christina Saldana. She is the owner of Camel City Wellness, and she's a physician's assistant. Camel City Wellness is an integrative women's health practice. She and I are going to dig into hormonal improvement and hormonal empowerment and how to navigate women's cycle changes in your 30s and beyond. So if you have any questions or you want to hear us talk about something on the podcast, be sure to email us at rachel@hugaabode.com. Until next time, be well, my friends, and see you again soon.